Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome. Come on in. Grab a seat or keep walking, whatever. Stand. Whatever's comfortable. Sit. If you're driving, don't stand up. I'm Jesse. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Way up here in the clouds today. It's pouring rain. That happens sometimes out here. Nice and refreshing, but sure does slow the traffic down, doesn't it? Today on the show, I am excited to be able to play a couple interviews recorded by Public Affairs Department Work Study William, one of them with an up-and-coming multimedia artist, and another with Noel from the Simon Fraser Public Research Interest Group, SFPIRG, or the PIRG, as we refer to them colloquially. And also, as usual, just a little bit of music to tie everything together. And we are, of course, going to get started with some local music. I, as you may know, host another program here on CJSF called the Vancouver Mixtape on Sunday nights with my good friend and co-host Jamie. And we do a run through of all the latest and greatest in Vancouver's independent music scene. And in doing prep for that episode, I discovered a new album by a band that is new to me called Smush. They appear to be new generally. Their first release on Bandcamp is from April 2024, at least. But this record is recorded at the Noise Floor Studios on Gabriola Island, which, if you are a regular listener to this program or just knowledgeable about Vancouver area music, you'll know that the Noise Floor is renowned for its great heavy sound and the great work of Jordan Coop down there. Anyway, we're going to hear a track by Smush, which is great sort of 90s shoegaze inspired music, with a track called Lizzie McGuire, which is also looking backwards. I guess Lizzie McGuire is more early 2000s than 90s, but we'll stick with it. Anyway, this is Lizzie McGuire by Smush on CJSF.
Thank you.
Lizzie McGuire by Smush from the new record, If You Were Here, I'd Be Home Now. Great record, which has a bunch of tracks like that and some sort of sample-y electronic synthesizer-y interludes, drawing a lot from My Bloody Valentine and other bands of the era. Great stuff. Yeah, the sort of poppy hooks on top of heavy distorted guitars right up my alley. Hopefully you enjoyed that as well. And now we're going to move on to the first interview that CJSF Work Study William produced. Did the research, wrote the questions, asked the questions, edited, etc. So we are going to start with his interview with artist Vin Quadra, and they do a great job setting everything up. So I will just let William and Vin take it from here, and I'll talk to you after.
All right, so hi, this is William Hofson with CJSF Speak Up, and today I'm with my friend, Vin Quadra. A little bit about yourself, please.
Hi there, my name is Vin Quadra. I am an emerging artist from Kwantlen Polytechnic University, studying under Bachelor of Visual Arts with a minor in Anthropology. I am a neurodivergent queer artist specializing in photography and new media. I am also a board member of the Ford Gallery and a member of the Langley Arts Council and the Kwantlen Art Collective at KPU.
Excellent. And you say your areas of expertise are new media and photo design. What really kind of sparked that passion for you?
First of all, like, I didn't even get into art that much when I was young. As a neurodivergent person myself, I had struggled with, like, my fine motor skills.
Totally relate there.
Yeah, definitely. And I would usually, like, look up to, like, artists, like, from, like, Filipino Catholic art to, like, Renaissance art to, like, see if I can match their level. But, like, thing is, like, you know, I was a little too young to, like, develop those skills anyway. So, like, I had that mindset, like, my art is not that good. And I felt, like, basically I couldn't even express myself out. But once I figured out photography back in grade 7 through, like, a group project, I felt like I had that passion and within me as well. Yeah. And I got introduced into Photoshop at around, like, grade 9. For a few projects, and I felt like it really suited my level four art for me.
Were there any, like, creators in general that, like, really helped exacerbate that passion for you? Because it seems like you looked up to a lot of people in your youth, but it mostly became, like, your personal vehicle, if that makes sense.
Exactly. I would say mostly, like, my surroundings around, like, my Catholic upbringing as well. Like, I've been seeing a lot of images of, like, sacred figures and idols, for example. And I have, like, relatives from the Philippines that were working in the movie industry as lighting directors. Oh, wow. And so I basically understood how would, like, the lighting setup go as well. And it was, like, a subconscious feeling for me when I found that spark.
That's actually fantastic. Like, I can tell you're an artist, of course, because that's going to give you some very vivid imagery to go with that. And you say, like, you grew up in the Philippines, and yes. when you immigrated to Canada, how old were you?
I was around 7 years old.
How was that like for you? How do you think it's, like, had lasting effects on, like, you, how you've grown as a person? Like,
yes, it did, actually. I've grown assimilated to, like, Canadian culture, but yet I still uphold, like, my Filipino traditions and values as well. However, whenever it comes to religion in Canada, like, the imagery itself, it feels a little too minimalistic, and I felt like I was a bit disconnected as well, and, like, the people as well. Like, I've been used to, like, talking to a lot of, like, Filipino people, even back in high school as well, in, like, elementary, and it kind of felt like a bit more disconnected with, like, the outside world just a bit. But now, look at me, I'm just, like, basically trying to be multicultural as I am, and I'm trying to include many people despite their, like, ethnicity or whatever, and I feel like I'm basically belong to like a lot of people anyways.
Yeah, it's like you got a different face for everybody.
I have a different face for everybody anyways.
And I can kind of definitely agree there about like wearing a face for different people.
Exactly.
And, I think there's something that's so satisfying about kind of integrating those faces into like the perfect whole, so people really see the real you. And I guess that's kind of what, or is that something you're trying to channel in your art? Like, what would you say is a piece of yours that really, I think, encapsulates who you are as a person?
There was this one. Oh, that's a really good question, actually. So there's a few pieces that relate to like my religion. For example, there I did like a piece where I basically use like images of like the crucifix.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's very interesting. And it's like I took him with like a Polaroid and I based him on like David Hockney like joiners to like represent my own Catholic and Christian upbringing, as well as there's this one AI generated video that I made since I'm a new media artist, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah,
there was this one AI generated video that I created with like Stalgan and like with Midjourney as well to convey like how I even myself and everyone perceives Jesus as well, because it is a very visual, ambiguous, anthropological perspective that people still debate upon.
Yes, like even beyond Jesus Christ, like, there's still so much debate. Even today, yesterday, I was listening to a friend's radio show, and they were talking about this religious holiday in China and how a lot of people interpret it as being celebrating the death of someone who was so fervently devoted to his culture, but then there are others who think it was he loved the emperor, and so like there's the people who interpret it through like a political lens, people who interpret it through a sexual lens, a religious lens, and I don't know, I just think that's something really interesting you can see in modern art, like
exactly.
The constant interpretation of different of the same idea but different in different way angles.
Yeah, I get that as well.
No, as a Catholic, as a Christian, like that's a huge tentpole of your character, your person. But you've also sort of like prefaced this interview with the fact that you identify as a queer person. And personally, I, even as someone who is fairly irreligious but has like educated themselves on the Bible, I think that it's very possible to reconcile both a queer identity and a Christian identity.
It is.
But there's a lot of discourse around, like, especially from the more conservative portion of the church. And I'm just wondering, like, what's your take on that? What is the way you've kind of, like, reconciled it with yourself? Like, any key moments in your life that made you think that, yes, I can reconcile the two?
That's a really good question, actually. Like, back when I was in high school, I was still figuring out what my sexuality is. And once I came out as, like, bisexual, or rather queer, and, like, an umbrella term, that's where I, like, found, like, Jesus as well.
Oh, wow.
It is.
That's interesting,
like,
yeah.
In a more conservative lens. However, like, when I was, like, attending this one church, I just felt very disconnected because not only that I spoke English as exclusively, or like a bit of like Tagalog, it's like basically I didn't even fit in with the individuals at all. It's because like they were like growing up with like a more Filipino traditional mindset rather than like a mindset like me where I could like see different perspectives as well. That's where I felt like a very very huge disconnection within myself. And then there was this one time that I had to cut someone off because he was like really questioning about how I view my sexual identity as a queer person. And it felt like at that point I'm just identified as like both Catholic and Christian with like a queer individual with a queer mindset as well. It feels like for me it's like let me just try to think about this.
Take your time.
Yeah. It feels like I'm fine being both Catholic and Christian with a queer identity, but the thing is, like, you know there's going to be a lot of people out there who's going to, like, judge you anyways, but, like, at the end of the day, it's only up to you. You can judge yourself and, like, who you perceive as, despite your religion or sexuality.
Yeah, and so much of, I think, where a lot of, like, modern Christian discourse fails to, like, grab people is
exactly.
The fact that it shouldn't be about your relationship with the church. It should be about your relationship with God. I mean, actually, maybe that's kind of wrong to say, because, like, obviously, the church is a huge foundation for someone's identity, for someone's relationship with mm-hmm. Christ. But I think at the end of the day, it comes down to, like, you having a dialogue with yourself and seeing what religious tradition, whether it be Christianity, Judaism, Islam, or, like, any other possible tradition, like, brings into your life. And
I get that.
For you, right, like, that's it's given you community and given you, like, artistic inspiration.
It really did.
And yeah, any more, like, left field inspiration? Like, I've obviously, like, we've obviously hung out a lot, so, like,
yes, exactly.
you're a big gamer too, right? And then you love music as well.
I love music as well.
Yeah, like, it's kind of an odd, because you're a visual artist, but, like,
yes.
Do you have any, like, music artists or games that, like, kind
that
of
inspire me,
that kind of inspire you as well? On a lighter note, of course.
Yeah, exactly, of course.
A bit, yeah.
So, I've been, like, very influenced by a lot of, like, electronic artists such as Porter Robinson,
mm-hmm.
Madion, and recently Misogi, because, like, they have, like, helped me
yes.
to find, like, my art style a lot, and, like, because, like,
actually, check that album out if you recommend it. It's pretty good. I enjoy
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I love it as well, actually.
I should give it another shot. I clicked with it, but I feel like there's still more to unravel. Like,
exactly.
That's a lot of the appeal of electronic music. Like, it really takes you some time to, like, work out every bit and piece of the recording. Kind of like classical in a certain way.
Exactly.
Or jazz. Like, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Nah, don't worry about it anyways, actually. Mm-hmm. So, to continue forward, they have, like, helped me to... They really focus on, like, the idea of living between the lines of, like, digitality and reality. I don't know if digitality is work, but, like, it could be, right?
I get what you mean,
like
the
digital,
comparison piece.
Like a digital life and
it's
reality.
It's like the ideal and the real, kind of.
Ideal and the real, basically. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, for me, I've been, like, living through this identity of, like, what's real or what's not. What's either going in my head, what's either going outside of my surroundings. It is, like, basically for me, it's, like, it's how, like, I kind of, like, developed as an artist as well, like, trying to, like, describe how I feel inside within, like, more of my surroundings as well,
mm-hmm.
even in, like, a anthropological context, because when I was young, I would watch a lot of, like, YouTube videos, like, documentaries of, like, certain cultures, groups, or whatsoever.
Any, like, specific names that really kind of, like, reach out to you, or is it, like, too far back to remember?
It's too far back to remember, mm-hmm. but I clearly remember that I kind of got more into art because of, like, Pacific Indigenous art.
Oh.
Yeah, so, like, Coast Salish art, because, like, I remember seeing those totem poles back in YVR before they were, like, renovated,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of, like, subconsciously made me think that would lead me to, like, becoming, like, a visual artist with a minor in anthropology and KP.
Right, yeah. Is it, how's that been going? Because I still think it's really impressive. I'm sorry I missed your display, but, like, being, like, the only non-graduated, like, student to have their work on display at
mm-hmm.
New West Art Gallery. Is that, that's the name of
no,
the place?
No, that's, right? Like, art. It's called I Heart New West Gallery.
Yes. All right, excellent. Yeah. So, like, is there a bit of, like, imposter syndrome? Or, because, like, that's really impressive.
Honestly, when I applied for that show, it was, like, a free for to get all or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically applied for it anyways, and I was, like, the only, like, non-graduate artist at that time, but, like, there were, like, a few more artists, so I didn't even feel alone.
Mm.
Anyway, so basically it kind of felt a bit honored that I was, like, displaying with the art with, like, a few fellow acquaintances, or rather graduates.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, that's something. Any, like, other artists you'd, like, be willing to shout out that you spent time with too? Like any other pieces of work there that kind of grabbed you from your colleagues, or you don't even have to name names, like, just some themes that really spoke to you in the art on display, if that makes sense.
There was, like, this one artwork where she was talking about, like, where this artist was talking about, like, a female Filipino rage. Actually, it was a very interesting concept.
Rage?
Yeah,
interesting.
It is feminine Filipino rage.
Mm.
It was, like, based all around this concept of, like, pare-pares, or, like, something around those lines. I'll have to, like, remember the word anyways. So it was just, like, this one girl who was, like, destroying, like, some type of, like, sculpture, and then, like, it was, like, it kind of was supposed to, like, represent, like, freedom from, like, colonialism. and my perspective and feminine Filipino rage.
I love that. Exactly. Yeah, now I'm even more sad that I missed out. But
it was like part of the Quixotic show back in KPU.
Oh yeah, okay. When was that?
It was back in April.
April. All right. Yeah. No. If there's footage online or if there are images online, I'm definitely gonna have to give it a look. But yeah. And okay. So, you've spoken as a new media artist. You obviously have a lot of interest and cachet in generative AI models.
Of course.
And it's such a contentious topic at this point. I'm actually going to be speaking with a member of an arts council in Victoria. Are you familiar with Juan Ramirez?
Juan Ramirez? I never heard of her.
It's all right. Yeah, no. He's like a software engineer who got really into generative AI models. And he has like a very optimistic perspective on the potential for AI models as a force for good in the art realm. And it's kind of caused him to be viewed as a bit of a prodigal son. And I kind of want to know like what your like exact thoughts on AI as a tool are in creative work and maybe even outside. Like, can you give me a little bit of like a picture there?
Of like how
how do you kind of conceptualize AI in the art world?
Honestly, the way I see AI, it's kind of like a tool for creating like new meanings and like new, like let's say false histories as well. Mm. Like I've been in like this one archaeology class where we were talking about like AI generated content and like how it harms the archaeology world as well.
It really muddies a lot of
it's like, a really a muddy record. Territory itself. Mm. Actually, it's like you're basically dealing with like history that's already been made and like you're trying to like elaborate on it without any further evidence. It's kind of interesting if you think about it.
Yeah,
but like the way I see AI, it's like it's kind of like a neutral field for me because like it's still a new field, right?
Mm-hmm. And relatively new. Yeah,
yeah. I would love to like try to work out with like more AI stuff, but like thing is like sometimes it's just kind of like what do you call that, like you're walking on thin ice, like whether you're just gonna like literally post it straight up on Instagram and say it like, oh, this is art, or like rather just like creating, or rather
you need to put a disclaimer.
Exactly, you're supposed to just put a disclaimer without any crediting any other artist. But like for my type of like AI, I would like to see on like how like video generated AI especially how it would like basically affect like the art world itself as well, because when it comes to video AI generated art, it could create some interesting results as well, because there will be like new meanings and like new ideas that pop up as well.
Yeah, like I haven't really delved into the territory of videos beyond like the friggin' Will Smith eating spaghetti clip, and also I've seen more and more companies trying to incorporate that into their brand. Like Marvel, I think they had a TV series where they had an AI-generated intro. Seriously? For the opening credits. Yeah, I think it's Secret Invasion. Like, I didn't watch it, but I think it did stir up a lot of controversy, but it's just something you just really can't escape. And I think, at best, it's not to, like, stick your head in the sand and try and avoid as a creative, right? You need to be able to adapt to the times, but you should also have like room to gatekeep. Like that's kind of what you're saying,
it's
right?
Because like there's I feel like there'll be more ethics around AI in like terms of art making. Because I remember talking to this one friend that AI is literally just a tool to help you on like how to like develop your own ideas and like and to like flesh it out, rather than just like using it as like a tool for like harmful means, such as like literally stealing from like other artists as well.
Yeah, I know.
And like saying that it's your work. It's literally just patchworking, anyways. Like, I mean, we live in a remix culture, and like I feel like this like remixing culture has gone a bit too far, especially in the realms of AI.
Yes.
And it's like you're basically not even like remixing; you're basically plagiarizing as well.
Mm-hmm.
But like for in terms of like my work in like AI, it's I try to like generate it so heavily that no one would recognize the style, and I would like basically try to like post edit it to seem like it's basically like what you're seeing, it's literally AI itself.
Yeah, like that's one of the things I've seen AI use best. It's like a commentary on technology and its role in society. Like that's kind of what this Juan Ramirez guy I've been speaking with. That's kind of his perspective in that, you can use it as a means to underline just how important, like, the individual creative is in the world of AI and in the world of new media, like they are still going to be the ones who they're going to be drawn from. They're going to be leading. They're going to be at the forefront. So I think if you're savvy, if you've got your like finger on the pulse of new media, you shouldn't worry too much. Maybe that's kind of an understatement. There's a lot of gray area.
It is actually.
Anyways.
Actually.
Yeah. So you told me a little bit as additionally, you've been doing a lot of like
point cloud modeling. Yes.
Point cloud. What is that?
Point cloud renders are basically like these renders where like every dot appears anyways from like a 3D model, and it kind of like generates this like cool effect as well.
Yeah, like so like every vertex has like a different image or
every vertex is connected as well, and like you turn them into like specks or like dots literally.
Oh, so it's kind of like pointillism, but
it's
like
almost like pointillism, but like for our age as well. It's a very interesting concept. Like it has been used in like forensics, archaeology, and even starting to become more used in art as well, which I kind of find fascinating.
You give me some like big, huge examples of like emergent works, emergent artists in that area that you've really been kind of tapped into, or
honestly, I've been like really focused on like both like Ali Fee's work as well. Mm-hmm. And within like the forensics field as well, so like forensic architecture, they're like really good. I would say almost like a forensic art collective, because they really focus on like how like architecture could affect like how architecture could affect like a forensic scene, for example. It's a very interesting concept.
Okay, that's really neat.
It is.
Yeah, because like forensics is like one of the most like multidisciplinary fields.
It is a very multidisciplinary field.
And like as an anthropology student, no doubt. You have done a lot of like work looking into that area.
Of course.
But also as an art student, and you're mentioning like these point clouds models, like do you have any other specific examples you think that art and anthropology can coalesce, or art and forensic science can coalesce? If
I would say most of my work is starting to become turned to like a more anthropological perspective, because like I've been helping out with like the KPU's field school for like their artifacts as well, basically. So I've been like taking photos of them, like photo editing, and I would say it's a very, very interesting process to see how like art, like how anthropology or like any related anthropological field can correlate within like a visual arts perspective as well. And not to mention that some of us like anthropology students we're a little weird, like to fine arts students, like of course we're all weirds at the end.
Yeah, I mean like there was a person, the arts and entertainment coordinator here, they've since resigned. They're also an anthropology major, and they were giving me like this whole history lesson on like the role of clowns in modern society.
So, exactly.
I'm not an anthro student, but like I can definitely see where the appeal lies. Like you really got to find that in history. Like you really got to find a niche for yourself.
Exactly.
Like latch onto, and for you, I guess it's like art. It's art history to an extent, but like and religious artwork too. But any other like cultures like outside maybe your own frame of reference too that you think kind of resonate with you?
There was this one work, one photographing installation I did. It's called Houses on Hogan's Alley, Before and Between Now and the Future. I basically use like the City of Archives' images of Hogan's Alley, which is like this one former ethnic neighborhood that has been gentrified, and I juxtaposed it with like my own photos as of the former area as well, like for that at the present time, and because I keep on like hearing about its redevelopment in the future.
Oh wow. Where is it?
Hogan's Alley is just like almost like near Chinatown. Chinatown.
I was thinking is this somewhere in the US or like
it's not in the US clearly, but it's in Vancouver though.
My sense of direction is horrible.
Exactly.
So I gotta check that place out. And I think, is there anything else you would like to add or plug your socials?
Plug my socials?
Yeah.
So my Instagram is vin.cdr, and I would say that's like my only social platform from now, but I'll be developing my own website soon as well, actually.
Any like companies in particular, like you've been working, or like models you've been working with? Because I know for my job, I do a lot of like stuff with Wix and.
I'm currently using Wix actually, but I might migrate to Squarespace, so it's going to be much more easier and professional.
Yeah,
of course.
For sure. And so your socials, anything we should really look forward to from you or in like the community in general that you might want to like bring to attention?
That's a really good question, actually. But like as of right now, I don't have any in mind. But some things about me that I actually did a mentorship with like the New Media Gallery. So like I know Sarah Joyce and like the other like people as well. So like they've really like made me more interested in like new media itself.
That's awesome to hear.
Yes, it is.
All right, then. I think that's it for today's interview. Please stay tuned for more. This is William Hofsink signing out. Vin Quadra, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, William Hofsink.
Yeah, no worries. Take care.
Thanks to William for conducting that interview and to Vin for being the other half. You can find some examples of Vin's work and get in touch if you'd like at on Instagram at vin.cdr, vin.cdr. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the one and only campus community radio station up here on Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University. And we will be right back.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs, interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures, public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
This is Speak Up on CJSF. I'm Jesse. Journey Towards Wholeness is the new record by Noreen Braun, who is a great Indigenous musician who's put out a whole bunch of records over the last little bit that have made their way onto the CJSF playlist and into my ears. This new record is a spiritual quest that delves deep into Braun's personal journey as an adoptee, exploring her Red River Métis heritage and uncovering a newfound sense of identity and belonging. It unfolds over 12 tracks in a conceptual story, and I'm going to play for you we're going to jump into the, well, not quite the beginning, but a track that lays it all out for us. This is Quest Before Me by Noreen Braun.
In the morning, I wake up my sleepy head. To the mirror, I find someone else instead. Looking back, questioning all I've said. Whose reflection gives pause to disguise a shed? Quest before me, do will I find in here? The layer, a faceless voice appears, invoking wisdom with words that I cannot hear. Wanderingless, distracted by flash and shine, panaceas and snake oil wasting time. Onward searching, the true self eludes my gaze. Hang on to things that will help to make me brave. Quest before me, and who will I find in here? Lake off the layers, a faceless voice appears, invoking wisdom with words
Me by Noreen Braun from her new record Journey Towards Wholeness, which is out now. This is Speak Up on CJSF, and we're going to hear now another interview conducted by CJSF Work Study William, this time with Noel from the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, and I'm just going to let the two of them take it away for now.
All right, hey, this is William Hofzink with CJSF Speak Up, and today I am with Noel of SFU PIRG. Noel, can you give me a little bit of a brief overview?
Hi, my name is Noel. I work at the SF PIRG, which is the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. I'm there as the Director of Engagement, and I'm super excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, excellent. So, Noel, tell me a little bit about yourself. What really got you engaged in public interest and social justice in general? Because I know it's a very different story for everybody.
Yeah, I think for me, I feel like I've always been kind of a person who likes to do political sort of work. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until college where I really met other folks that were doing that sort of work in a way that made sense to me.
Right.
I went to a university in the United States, and there was just a really rich tradition of sort of Black radical organizing there. So I sort of took a lot of my thinking and practice from that time. And that's sort of what got me into doing public interest and also just political organizing in general.
You told me you were at Brown for a couple of semesters. How do you think the experience at an Ivy League school in the U.S. differs from back in Canada? Do you think that there was a huge cultural shift and a way that in which activism is portrayed? If I'm making sense?
Yeah, I think the in a lot of ways there isn't really differences. I think there's like a lot that is like with a lot of different universities, like they offer the same things, but there is this sort of image of prestige and this image of a kind of like unique type of learning that I don't think I guess just like in the same ways that you have like classes filled with like hundreds of people here that like don't maybe like have the most resources or, you know, folks don't get a ton of time with professors and things. Like, those problems sort of, like, translate across. I think the difference, to me, the biggest differences have to do with, like, people's access to resources after they graduate and even during their time there. I think that, you know, a lot of people, there are a lot of, like, communities that what's the best way to put this? I guess just that like a lot of the ties that people form at I think like Ivy Leagues or just like elite institutions in general, you often have people in industry, people who are, you know, working in other like parts of the economy that will gravitate to hiring those people and gravitate to bringing those people on into their sort of parts of the division of labor. And I think what that means is that a lot of folks that go to these kinds of schools have advantages when they're going on the job market. But outside of that, it's not like you get, like, any kind of, like, special, like, new niche knowledge or anything like that. It's, you get the, I mean, you're going to, like, study calc here. You're going to study calc there. It's going to be, like, the same education. But yeah, so I think the advantages on the job market are really the big difference. And I think a lot of that has to do also with, like, nepotism and these things that are, like, endemic at these places. So
Daddy donated a building.
Yeah, Daddy donated a building, and now I get to come to class whenever I want and never do assignments and all the nine. Those are the differences, I think, that come to mind.
Yeah, so I know that there's a huge work-study program at SFU. I know I'm actually part of it because of my financial situation. But do you think that there's a lot of draw to people who might be in a similar situation that I am to public interest groups? Or do you think there's a way you can, like, maybe expand the net there? Because I don't know. Like, I think that there's a lot of great opportunities to be had in public interest research, not just for people who are already interested, but like how do you think you can get more people engaged?
Well, one of the things that we're doing right now, I'll say, we're sort of working on a new project that feels exciting to sort of bring people on to our like work study and volunteering and just into the perg in general. I will say one of the things that we're doing right now that and have been doing for a little while that is through the work study is the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside.
Tell me a little about that.
So that program is basically a program where folks that are incarcerated make different kinds of like research and information requests to folks on the outside, and then we sort of like craft responses to try and share as much like knowledge and information across these sort of like prison walls that are not very porous when it comes to information and knowledge that is like allowed to move. And so to sort of undermine that control that the state has over what people can know and access in prison, we sort of do these sort of research requests and engage in these sort of pen pally kind of relationships.
Like, it almost makes me wonder too about kind of recidivism being a bit of like a closed circuit too, because with that lack of information spent, you know, and the time spent within the walls of prison, do you think it might make it even harder for someone to readjust into civilian life and maybe find themselves in more criminogenic environments, criminogenic situations?
I think that, to me, I think that would be one of, like, many things that, like, make, like, a recidivism happen. Like, I think that definitely, like, folks, like, access to information could be a part of that. I think in general, just people's, like, connectedness to other humans. Mm-hmm. Like, so much of, I think, like, what the prison tries to do is really just isolate people and sort of make them feel very, very alone. Or at least that's how I understand it, not having actually been inside myself. And so I think that, yeah, cutting people off from information and knowledge is one part of that, but I think that there's so many different forces at work that produce recidivism as a kind of phenomenon, and this revolving door that is the prison, where folks exit and then come back in.
I totally understand there. Like, it almost feels counterintuitive when you're denying someone who wants to improve, wants to make up for their crimes, no matter like how horrifying, or portrayed as horrifying, because obviously like we don't know the full story. Then they want the information to be able to turn over a new leaf, and yet they just don't get that. And speaking of like information too, I can tell that the Perg has like this incredible collection of literature and of artwork as well. Can you tell me a little bit about some of like the highlights you've been reading or you would recommend? Because there's a book club too.
Ooh, oh my goodness. Sort of also connected to our new work study project or one of an emerging one, which is our like People's University project, a sort of program for political education. And so we're doing some study groups and some teach-ins through that. One of the books that is going to be a sort of study group for us is going to be How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, which I would highly recommend to anyone. It's a sort of work on underdevelopment in Africa and sort of political economy in general. It's really, really fantastic. And sort of like argues, I think in a lot of ways, or tries to demonstrate the need for like Africa to break from the sort of like international capitalist system. So that is a really cool book. One that I've been reading lately that I finished recently was The Caliban and the Witch, which was a really good book.
I caught you reading that on the bus too. Yeah.
No way. I've definitely read it quite a bit on the bus. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little about that too? Because from my understanding, it's like kind of taking a Marxist feminist perspective on the economy throughout history, or?
Yeah, exactly. It sort of attempts to revisit primitive accumulation in Marx's works, which is like sort of this time or this sort of idea that is all about like capitalism coming into being, like what accumulation has to happen in order for capitalism to start to stand on its own legs. And so often people think of like colonialism, people think of enslavement, but one of the sort of examples, the historical examples that Silvia Federici kind of goes to is the witch hunts, and the witch hunts as an example or a sign of kind of primitive accumulation and the role that the witch hunts had in sort of alienating women and femme people and folks in general from their own bodies, and their ability to sort of assert their own agency in the sort of human reproductive process, right? Because what she sort of argues is that in the sort of entire scheme of things, right, we think of Marx is really interested in production, he's really interested in like how we make things and all this kind of stuff, and a big part of that, like one of the commodities that gets made, and he sort of calls a commodity himself, is labor power, right? Our like our literal life being, the thing that we all have, the ability to like kind of work in labor. And she sort of points out that it's sort of women I guess you could say like just like folks who are engaged in a certain kind of reproductive labor that actually produce labor power. And so we've kind of not really explored that idea enough, and she
the specific role of like the feminine in the means of production, like
sort of understanding, I think, like, the body as a part of the means of production.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right? And the ways that the capitalist class, right? One of the examples she gives, which is really cool, is that, you know, in the sort of, like, late feudal period, the sort of end of the Middle Ages, you have the Black Death, which kills, like, a bunch of people. And like a third of Europe's population. And so this creates like a situation that's actually really good for wage workers, because there's like less competition in the labor market. And so that means that they can sort of, you know, have higher wages or push for higher wages in a way that is difficult for the capitalist class. And so what she sort of argues is that the capitalist class in concert or in tandem with, you know, the feudal nobility and these sort of other interests, they actually go to huge extents to prevent, or rather to encourage or force women to reproduce so that they can actually increase the population and sort of like dampen the sort of win that workers had in a certain sense when there was a lower population. And so we see sort of like all kinds of stigma associated with like non-procreative sex come at this time, right?
Especially with the impact of the church too.
And
even so tying back to the witch hunt. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Carry on.
No. 1,000%. Right. We see like stigma against homosexuality. We also see like the sort of criminalization of all kinds of like contraceptive activity, right? Which are sort of like tied to what folks understand as witches. So many different things. We see the introduction, or the removal of midwives from the birthing process, and sort of male doctors being responsible for the birthing process, and these sort of like demographic statistics beginning to like be taken and emerge to account for the population increases and all these things. So sorry, that was me going off on
that. No, that was amazing.
We'll be right back with the second half of William and Noelle's conversation here on CJSF. Welcome back here on CJSF. Now pleased to bring you the second half of William's interview with Noelle from the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group.
I think like one of the beautiful things about the Purg, especially when I first like engaged myself with the material and especially like the literature, there's so many different marginalized perspectives you can draw from. Like you had those books of W.E.B. Du Bois, and you had a lot of great LGBT authors, but I still see I still see a lot of division in marginalized groups, like. Who gets to speak? Like, there are a lot of anti-transgender activists who identify as LGB, even in this book I've been reading, ML Ferris's My Favorite Thing Is Monsters, there's an incredible scene, it's heartbreaking, in the first book where the main character's best friend, they are accosted it's set in the 1960s, they're accosted on a bus by a fellow black man, and at the time this person identifies as a black man, but they later go on to identify as a transgender woman, and they get accosted with all these like slurs, and like they're even told straight up, like following the death of MLK, like this their kind is not for civil rights. And it's just an honestly heartbreaking scene to see so much division in a time when like unity is needed the most. And obviously like we've progressed a lot in accepting transgender folks and LGBT folks, people of like not like non-traditional religious backgrounds too. But do you think there's a way that we can even improve like unity among the marginalized even more so?
Absolutely. I think that you know, one of the things that makes me think of is also the ways that we're watching like a kind of like reversal of like the sort of like move toward acceptance, and this sort of like this world where, you know, queer and trans folks have become increasingly safe. I think when we look to the United States, when we look to the bathroom bills, when we look to all of these sorts of like kinds of like legislation that criminalize like drag, and we see these like also forms of legislation starting to emerge in like conservative parts of this country, or through different kinds of like conservative parties being introduced to the legislatures. I think that there's so much to be done. And I think that I think there's lots of ways that that can look, but I think a big part of that will just, I think, be one, like, building people's, like, political consciousness and growing people's political consciousness all the time, which, you know, people are doing, and there's lots of people working on that, but the more the merrier, and I also think, you know, really defending queer and trans folks' rights and understanding that a lot of the things that queer and trans folks need and deserve and are fighting for are things that we all kind of need and deserve and are fighting for. Like, I think about, you know, you talked about, like, radical activists that, you know, are anti-trans, but maybe call themselves LGB. I think about the ways that, you know, trans folks kind of struggle for body sovereignty. It feels very similar to the struggle of folks with vaginas to, you know, sovereignty over their own bodies when it comes to sort of, like, reproductive rights and these kinds of things. So I think there's so many ways that, you know, we're really all on the same team, like, or we're all, like, kind of asking for the same stuff. So I hope that those things become, like, bases for unity and sort of points that we can align on and places where bridges can be built.
I agree completely. Like, I know my experience is a bit different, but as a person with a disability, right, I see a lot of infighting too on that front, whether it be from people with physical versus invisible disabilities, or even just other marginalized groups, or even, like, companies that put up a face to say that they're all for inclusion, but then when it actually comes to down to the complexities of integrating more accessible work environments, whether that be on the basis of race, on the basis of sexuality, on the basis of ability, they just balk under it because it's too much of a cost. But what people don't see is, like, when you take the time to accommodate other people, if the accommodations improve the quality of whether it be pedagogy, whether it be employment, just even production for everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think, yeah, you couldn't have said it any better. Okay, I think we've gone and covered quite a lot of ground. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the air. Is there any, like, closing statements you'd like to make? Like, plug your socials or the PERG in general?
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at SFPERG, just SFPIRG. We're also on Facebook. We have a website. And sort of coming up for us, the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside, we do, or are having, rather, a little volunteer day, an onboarding session that's going to be happening on June 24th from 2 to 4:30. So come by for that. And yeah, just stay in tune, stay in touch, follow us so you can know what we're doing next. And we can't wait to see you.
Woo! All right, that was Noelle with William on CJSF Speak Out. Tune in next time. Adios.